Our baseball writer Eric Prisbell had a sit-down with Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred. He'll talk about it and where baseball stands heading into October. Then we'll turn to NHL writer Mark Burns, who has a season preview of that league. And we'll close with executive editor and publisher Abe Madcore talking about what we're watching across the sports business. All that and whatever else comes up once we get talking here in the newsroom of Sports Business Journal. I'm Bill King, and this is First Look. The Dodgers and Yankees both eclipsed 100 wins this season. Jason Verlander threw his third no-hitter. And a pair of juniors, Ronald Acuña and Vlad Guerrero, emerged as budding superstars. And if you dig the long ball, boy, it's been a great season to be alive. Unless, of course, you're unsettled by the drumbeat of labor discord, the downward trend in attendance, or a range of nuanced issues tied to pace of play. Our baseball writer Eric Prisbell recently sat down with the commissioner to talk about a range of issues, and he's in to join us now. Eric, one of the things that jumped out to me, obviously, that with baseball and all the games that are out there on local broadcast, that becomes a huge issue. So this Sinclair deal, which, you know, baseball was a bidder on those Fox RSNs, they land with Sinclair. You talked to him a little bit about that. Let's talk about some of the of what he perceives as the pluses and what a lot of people might wonder whether they might be minuses of that deal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was a really interesting point, Bill, I wanted to bring up with the commissioner. And his main emphasis was, you know, the first thing, they learned a lot through this whole situation.
Through the negotiation of the deal itself?
Yeah, and it was an educational process for MLB. And he says if they weren't going to win, Sinclair was a good outcome for us. At least that's what the way he's presenting it at this point. You know, his thoughts were the leverage they have as a result of retransmission leverage is really important in terms of distribution of those RSNs. That's exactly what he said. They obviously want full distribution, but he's formed a good working relationship with Chris Ripley, Sinclair's president and CEO. They've had a lot of conversations about how the two can work together and make sure it's a positive outcome. So that's the way they're presenting it. It's a positive situation, but they certainly we're going after that. We're going after the RSNs, and you know Sinclair's a $10.6 billion deal, so it's significant.
Yeah, one of the things that I wonder about is that you had that symbiotic relationship between Fox, which really is the flagship broadcaster for MLB in some ways, especially when you think about the All-Star Game. Well, especially when you think about the postseason. And so you had that natural symbiotic relationship between the RSNs and Big Fox. The loss of that, I wonder whether that's a bit of a ding.
You know, I think it would have to be. I mean, I understand he wants to put a positive spin on it for sure. But, you know, Fox has been such a great partner for them, you know, locally and nationally. And it would seem like that, yeah, the symbiotic relationship moving forward would benefit everybody. So I think it was a loss to some degree for MLB.
So on that broadcast front, we all know broadcasts are changing. Local streaming rights has been a big issue across baseball. You guys talked about that, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, because I have been hearing that this is almost inevitable, that clubs are going to be able to sell their digital rights to local broadcasts. And it's just a matter of time. It's going to be a couple months. It's going to be a year, maybe more than that. So I really wanted to drill down on that with the commissioner, and he was clear. He said there's going to be a change in that area. They are going to be able to sell the digital rights to local broadcasts. I tried to get a window of timing on that. He was less clear on that. He said it's still a governance issue at this point, but he said it's not a matter of years. It'll be sooner than that, and I think that's what everybody's expecting as well.
So you talked to him some about competitive integrity is the phrase that gets thrown around now, right? Competitive integrity. And that's that question, especially as it applies to the bidding of free agents and what it's done to salaries, and particularly what it's done to salaries of some veteran players. What do you have to say about that?
Exactly. I mean, and this is really interesting, I think, and you and I have talked about this a little bit, but, you know, I met with the MLBPA a couple of weeks ago and talking to the commissioner and others as well. It's good to get the two sides on the issues. But the union really believes that there's a significant issue with competitive integrity, that there's not enough teams, there's not enough clubs, and not enough owners who year to year are trying to create a roster that will compete for a championship, that they're not only below the threshold for a luxury tax, but they're well below it. And they're not trying to put together a competitive team. And right. There's no incentive to try to win 75 when you can win 70, or to win 80 when you can win 75. That could be addressed. I think that's a fair point to some degree. On the other side, the commissioner pointed out, obviously, look at the playoffs.
Yes.
You've got Milwaukee, a small market in the playoffs, and they're thriving. And the Minnesota Twins and Tampa Bay, and they have issues with Tampa, and they're in the playoffs.
Hey, look, Tampa and Oakland being the two wild cards, that makes this a very difficult argument for the Players Association to make at this point. Whether Tampa or Oakland, and I think Oakland certainly is still within that window of competing when you consider what their talent is. Tampa was not. And, you know, this was thought to be a strip down and a rebuild. And guess what? Right. Look at how it turned out on the field.
Exactly. And he said, if I could quote him, I think the competitive integrity is a synonym for the MLBPA thinking that 33-year-old free agents should get paid more.
One of the great lines he had in this, by the way.
Yeah, and that also underscored kind of the relationship or the tenor between the two sides right now, I think, and a kind of a harbinger for things to come. And we got a long way to go on the labor strife side in this, and there's some tensions there. There's a lot of issues that need to be resolved. And there's a lot at stake. And I think, there was no real progress made during this season. And I'm not sure anybody really expects much progress during this offseason. So we have a long way to go at that front. And that's just kind of teasing some of the issues that are at play.
Yeah, I think the clogged free agent market of these last two offseasons certainly has been a sticking point for the players. And when the union is talking to veteran players who want to know why I'm not getting the deals that the guys before me were getting, there's no doubt that you're not. But that really dovetails into something else you talked about, and that's the increasing roles that analytics play. I mean, I think what's happened is that clubs are doing the math and they're looking at what it costs to bring in that 32-year-old free agent and what that player's war or more sophisticated version of war, wins above replacement is. And when they look at that and they do the math, they say, you know, this 32-year-old guy who's going to require X million dollars or double digit million dollars versus this, you know, 25-year-old guy who we can plug in there. Is he our future at the position? No, maybe not. But how many more games do we win based on that veteran player? Not many. Where can I put those resources instead? That's the calculus. That's the reality. It's not something that is particularly great to hear if you're a 32-year-old third baseman.
Right. I think that issue is complicated. It's so fascinating. I think analytics certainly has changed the game dramatically. I think it's helped the game years ago, in the last 10, 15 years or so. Now, you're right. Clubs are using analytics. They're using their own formulas to derive the value of players and the value of free agents based on what their analytics say. So that's changed the game. That's changed the free agent market, I believe. And the union doesn't expect anyone to turn back time. They're not expecting 33-year-old free agents to all of a sudden now get big money again. But I think they do have an issue with analytics and how clubs, in their view, may overuse them to reinforce what they, think the market should bear for that player. And that also creates another dynamic where the player plays to the analytics and tries to have a skill set and a performance that bolsters, what the analytics say that their value is. So I think overall, baseball's confronted with a lot of issues. All sports are right now. But these issues are more complicated, more nuanced than they're often portrayed. And you and I have talked about it. Every generation, every 10 years, there's a narrative that's created that says that baseball is dying and here's why. And it changes every 10 years. And that narrative certainly is at play right now. But what struck me about talking to the commissioner, he's very clear, expansive, and really well-reasoned on why he doesn't think the sport is dying at all. And there's a lot of positives to showcase as well.
I thought it was interesting. He said, have we done a good job managing the changes that analytics have brought to the game? And I honestly think that is more about on the field than anything else. When you think about pace of play has been the Rob Manfred issue, I think, for several years now. We hear it again and again and again. And if you want to think about pace of play, I've argued forever that pace of play has slowed. And there's lots of reasons, and pitching changes are one, and there's other things. But look, it just takes longer to process the information as people make decisions between pitches. And it takes more in time to process the information as defenses reset. And all those things that are a product that, you know, the analysis takes time. And I think that the thought process of a player on the field is very different today than it was 10 years ago and maybe even 5 years ago. And oh, by the way, if I see one more outfielder take out a card at the beginning of the inning to see where he's supposed to stand, my head's going to explode.
That's a great point, a great illustration of what we're seeing right now. And what I'm hearing is, you know, it's changed the game. In some ways, it's helped the game, helps clubs win. But at what cost? Does it marginalize the manager? I think it has. Does it marginalize the instinct and how much that's involved in baseball? I think it has. And when you're in the outfield, you pulling out a card, and, you know, where should I be, and what's the percentage on this? I think it takes a lot of that stuff out. It certainly changes the game. And that's a great point about how it slows the pace of the game as well, the length of the game. And I really wanted to drill down with him. It's not the length.
No, it ain't length of the game. That's not his concern.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, you could give me a four-hour postseason baseball game. It's as dramatic as anything. But it's the what's the pace of the action? How much dead spots are there in the game? And how much can that be remedied? Now, I talked to Stan Kasten at the Dodgers recently, and he had a different view on it. He said, you know, our sport's different. It's not nonstop action. But let's make the best use of those dead spots in a game. How do we reach fans in the ballpark for more interactive activities, whether it's social media, who knows what it is, participatory, personalized engagement during those times to keep them interested. And I think that's a different way to look at it as well. You know, and a lot of this, you know, goes back to attendance as well. And, you know, they're looking at about a 1% dip from last year. You know, the trend isn't great, but it's not great in a lot of sports. And minor league baseball attendance is up. Little league participation is up. Mm-hmm. So they're positive on that. And, you know, Manfred still loves the fact that you got 68 million people coming to their games each season. It's 81 home games. It's a lot. But there are bright spots around the country among the 30 clubs that he likes to focus on. And I've talked to the Oakland Athletics, and they have a subscription-based model now, A's Access. They've doubled their season ticket members, as they call it, and their average age of their members has dropped by 11 years in just one season. So, you know, there are some bright spots as well.
Yeah, there are. We got to a few of them. There's lots more in this Q&A people should dig into it this week. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Anytime.
The St. Louis Blues had a ton of momentum building as they headed into 2019. On New Year's Day, the NHL announced that the Blues would host the 2020 All-Star Game. Soon after that, they locked down a promising new deal with the local ESPN radio station. And they were completing work on a spiffy new training center that promises to raise the profile of hockey in St. Louis. As a business, the Blues were thriving. As a hockey team, not so much. On January 3rd, the Blues resided in hockey's cellar, with the fewest points of any team in the league. We all love worst-to-first stories. In only 5 months, the Blues went from worst all the way to their first Stanley Cup championship ever. So that was the story of last year's NHL season, an extraordinary season. As we head into this year, we bring in our Mark Burns, our NHL writer Mark Burns, to talk a little bit about this upcoming season. Mark, an extraordinary year that the NHL comes off of. How do you think that dovetails into this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the league, to what you said, the league's coming off a big year in which the Blues won their first cup. Record ratings coming out of the Stanley Cup, out of the finals. And yeah, I mean, the league has a lot to look forward to. I mean, I think they were the only league across the Big Four of the States that had viewership numbers were up in 2018, 2019. So can the Blues repeat? Obviously a storyline that I'm following. I'm sure a lot of people are following. With the Pens recently repeating, maybe it's a little too soon for another club to repeat, but obviously watching that. You know, even on the ice, they just made a big signing in Justin Falk coming from the Hurricanes and making a big splash there. So yeah, lots to look forward to if you're a St. Louis Blues fan. And that's good for, you know, the NHL. I mean, first cup in, I think, their franchise's fifth year. History took a half a century, but, you know, they eventually got a cup. So
well, they got the, you know, they, they, they got that great combination that because it's one thing to have the storyline when the storyline is in a market that's like, you know, Raleigh, for example, could be a great storyline. There's all sorts of markets that have great storylines, but they paired it with the Bruins, which is major media market, great history, great tradition, original franchise, tie that into the St. Louis storyline. They sort of got the best of both worlds.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. Yeah, I mean, you kind of had the best of both worlds. The league, NBC, everybody was super excited and happy about that.
So let's talk a little bit again about heading into this season, looking across the league. You know, you did some great snapshots looking at some changes. The Colorado Avalanche, let's start with them.
Yeah, I mean, they've, you know, from a business standpoint, they're one of the teams that we've obviously highlighted in the season preview. They're doing some things differently from a technique standpoint. I think this goes... I mean, I don't think a lot of clubs are doing this, but they're one in particular that's getting more efficient. I would say more effective in just like how they go about targeting, at the end of the day, targeting their end customer, their end
right,
fan.
Right.
So they recently implemented a new ticketing system and basically how they put fans along what they call fan journey from the moment that a person buys a ticket to the moment that they could potentially become, a season ticket holder or potentially be part of a group package or some other type of package beyond just buying an individual ticket. And so, between working with their sales department, the box office staff, I think Altitude Tickets and also like their intelligence team, all those people like working together to implement this. So, I think you're seeing a lot of clubs do that, but they're one in particular that, just did this and is implementing it for the upcoming season.
So is that all about turning lead generation into a sale? Is that what a lot of that is?
Yeah, I mean, essentially what it is, being more efficient with lead generation and kind of using back-end analytics, the business intelligence team, software that they have internally to be more efficient and just basically have a better chance of closing that sale once they have somebody like in their pipeline, essentially.
I was also struck, you think about some interesting tech that's out there. The LA Kings doing more with virtual reality, is that right?
Yeah, they're doing some things, in the mixed reality AR space. They have a new AR partner, a company out of Vancouver, ProX Media, has an app product that essentially is, a fan engagement sort of tool. So if you download the app, you're at the arena, and you can take a virtual hologram of like a mascot or one of the Kings players. Really never seen a team have like an official AR partner.
Right.
It seems like it is a new category in some respects. even across, not even just like the NHL, but like other leagues. I don't think I've ever really seen that. So yeah, more opportunity for, sales and sponsorship people to close a deal. It's great for the social digital folks, the tech people at the clubs. Everyone kind of wins, especially the fans.
And so let's what we think about is we so often think about that technology in terms of game, in terms of game presentation, right? That's not what this is, right? This is more of an on concourse, on concourse with a mascot, right?
Yeah, on course with the virtual mascot. So basically, you download the app and you're on the concourse in certain areas and can take a photo next to the virtual, Bailey the mascot popping up, or one of your favorite players. Definitely getting that fan engagement and getting closer to your customer. Everyone's got a smartphone, basically in 2019.
Right.
I think a lot of ideas and concepts, and they all generate obviously from the phone because that's one thing everybody has.
A lot going on with the Islanders.
Yeah, it's a lot going on. I mean, between just breaking ground at Belmont Park. That's going to be finalized in the next couple of years. But yeah, just broke ground. Now, the Islanders and OVG, they can kind of go to the market look for founding partners and naming rights and all that. Once you have a shovel in the ground, that it becomes a different conversation. So, you have that going on, which just happened this week with Governor Cuomo.
Right.
And now you have, they just launched a new marketing campaign this year called and they call it family, quote unquote family, but the tagline is our tribe, our family, I believe it is.
Right.
And this is, for 2019-20,
right.
Maybe moving into maybe next season. You go to games and you meet strangers, and, you know, strangers become kind of friends, they become family, and so everyone's sort of in this together. So kind of really honing in on family.
Lots to look forward to there in Long Island. Well, it's so interesting because here you've got this team that had this connection with the island. You had this connection as Long Island's team. You move to Brooklyn, you become this cool hip thing, you change colors, you do all this other stuff. And then you go back, and when you play games on the island, all of a sudden that's the most electric it gets, right? I mean, they're going to have to play two Rangers games out there, I think, this year. So that whole Our Tribe thing gets really, I think, gets really interesting as they move into this next incarnation, or maybe it's a reincarnation.
Yeah, I think it's a reincarnation. I mean, it really is like Long Island's team. It's not, you know, I don't think it's Brooklyn's team. I would say it's Long Island. I mean, look, like when they go, you know, they play at the Coliseum, this old building that is tiny and seats 15,000.
Hockey barn.
But, you know, yeah, it's a barn, but they fill it out. People love going there. It's a different atmosphere. I mean, when they play at Barclays, obviously that arena wasn't created for hockey.
No.
It's created for basketball. So the sight lines are bad, and it's just not the greatest experience from a fan standpoint. So the new arena is obviously going to be great. And I think, yeah, this will kind of this marketing campaign, you know, who knows, maybe it stretches longer than this year. Maybe they tweak it once they officially open Belmont Park in a couple of years.
Last one I want to touch on, you know, everybody, I think people think community relations, the Vegas Golden Knights do it really, really well. And now here they are doing something new, right?
Yeah, they are sponsoring local teams.
And not just hockey teams, right? I mean, that's the key point here, not hockey teams.
Yes, not hockey, yeah. Soccer, basketball, baseball, football, other sports. And, yeah, they're sponsoring clubs and also, you know, providing some financial support for jerseys and equipment. And, yeah, it's just something totally different. I don't really know of anyone else doing this. I mean, some teams have, like, their junior, you know, like the Predators have, like, a junior Predators. And I know
everybody does juniors. Yeah, everybody does juniors hockey. Yeah. To me, the real eye-catching thing here is the expansion beyond to sort of do good across youth sports, which, I mean, we've seen lots of declines, lots of problems, and lots of concerns.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Yeah, I mean, they're encouraging participation in youth sports, you know, encouraging also not specializing in, you know,
right,
a sport when you're 5 years old or, you know, playing hockey for your entire life. And hopefully, yeah, if you're playing other sports, you know, you learn skills from there that can translate to not only hockey, but, you know, even other sports that you're playing. So, yeah, I'm interested to see if other teams, you know, maybe replicate this or even, you know, modify it in some respect. But yeah, to what you said, great way to get their brand out there. Not that it wasn't already in the Nevada area, but great branding kind of initiative. Marketing initiative, but also, you know, obviously working close with the community.
So last thing I wanted to touch on with you, we started with the Blues. Let's go back to the Blues. What are they looking at coming off of that Stanley Cup from a business standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, because of the momentum is, you know, it's still, you know, it's, I wouldn't say at an all-time high, but you just came off the Cup. You know, you start the season, fans are obviously super jacked up. They want a repeat, you know, looking for, you know, new partners and all that. I haven't heard anything of, you know, anything really closing yet coming off the season, but, you know, it sounds like they still have a lot of momentum and, you know, they can still leverage that into, you know, new conversations, continue the conversation with some partners that they already have and upsells, you know, a lot of excitement still there in St. Louis.
All right, Mark, great stuff. As we head into this NHL season, look forward to chatting with you again. Mark Burns, thanks so much.
Sounds good. Thanks, Bill.
Take care, man. As we close First Look each week, I bring in our executive editor and publisher, Abe Madcore, to talk about what we're watching in the sports business. Abe, what do you got?
Well, you guys covered a lot of great stuff, but I know we're recording this on Friday, and I've got a couple things that...
Wait, wasn't this IPO day?
Yeah, and it's a big story, and it's going to have a lot of ripples, and I know that you've been thinking a lot about it, but I mean, Endeavor not going forward with its IPO last week is a really big, I think, statement for the sports business industry, because remember, it wasn't just Endeavor planning to do an IPO. You were looking at CAA eventually.
That's right.
And other large agencies who are all watching this. So it's hard to say whether this was a result of the marketplace right now or whether investors don't like this type of business. What they didn't like from the people I talked to was the amount of debt that Endeavor has. Mm-hmm. And that scared off a lot of investors. And apparently some I talked to said that in the roadshow, and you can watch the roadshow online. It was pretty interesting. It's on retailroadshow.com, and you can look at all roadshows. But there were some questions about really, was it debt or was it just future revenue to be realized? There was a lot of questions about the transparency there. A lot of issues, Bill, I'm looking at. Will they come back in 2021? Because they're definitely not coming back for the end of this year. I said already, what does it mean for other large agencies? Third, internal morale at Endeavor is going to be hit by this, no doubt about it. Ari Emanuel put this as really his major accomplishment. And if you worked at IMG Endeavor for a long time, you were looking to get some liquidity.
That was the end game, right? This is going to go, we're taking this public. Whenever anybody joins an organization and hears we're taking this public, they expect that day.
And if you didn't get that payday and you're not going to get that payday in 2019, has to be a little discouraging and deflating for people who've worked a long time there. So that's an issue that Ari and Mark Shapiro are going to have to deal with. But a very, very interesting story. People should pay attention to this and the really ripples of the story.
Yeah, and what I think is interesting about it too is, what is this really, okay? And we'll know that in the coming weeks. Because if this is just, we've seen the marketplace, we've seen others go out, you've seen several high-profile IPOs go out, and they're down a few days later, a few weeks later, they're down on issue date, all those sort of things that, you know, is it that you see that and you say that's not what we want, or is it something else? Because if it's something else, that's a very different thing than, hey, the timing is bad.
And that's the investor community, which I can't really read that well.
Right.
Another thing, I was out in California last week at our sports facility and franchise conference. And even though this issue doesn't cross necessarily into that space, when we asked what story are people watching, everybody's watching California Bill 206.
Yeah.
I was surprised by how much discussion there was about the California bill, which wouldn't be implemented for a few years, but is sitting on Gavin Newsom's desk. He could sign it as early as this week.
And what's that bill?
And that is the name and likeness bill with college athletes. And so you're seeing a lot of the Mark Emmert responded, saying that they're not trying to strong arm California. Gene Smith responded saying they won't play teams in California because they won't be collegiate athletes. There is a lot here, and other states are starting to submit similar legislation. I do think we'll have Mark Emmert at our event in December. This could be the biggest threat to the underpinnings of college sports that I've seen outside of congressional action.
It is. And what happens in other states is really, for me, what's going to drive a lot of this. Because if this is just California, then I do think that the NCAA does have the leverage and could say, you know what, I'm sorry, but if that bill passes, your teams are just not going to be eligible for our championships. And you could, even though California is a big deal, you could say that's one state. If this is in five states, six states, seven states, and again, politics and the NCAA is really interesting because when you talk about the lobby of pro sports, that's one thing. It's one thing to exert some leverage through wealth and the position in a community that a pro sports team might hold. It's entirely another one you're talking about collegiate sports, because now you're talking about a university president, and that by its nature at a state-funded institution is a tremendously connected position. And that conversation becomes, that's what I mean, a political position. And that conversation is very, very different. And the NCAA over the years has used that to its advantage as it's tried to get things done in states, because when the university president and the head football coach can go to the governor, that's a good thing. This one is the other way around. They might be on the wrong end of this math.
And even Gavin Newsom said he realizes the consequence of this decision because, quote, we could substantially change the NCAA as we know it, end quote.
So, or the NCAA could change California athletics as we know it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I'm keeping an eye on that. I would suggest all our listeners at least keep an eye on that. I want to ask you one thing. In 10 seconds or less.
Wait. Do you? How many years have you known me?
That's why I try to frame it. What is the significance of the DraftKings deal with the NFL?
Okay, it's a daily fantasy deal. And the NFL didn't have one before, and now they do. And if this were any other year, we would say, well, the NFL has entered a category. It's finally gotten comfortable, and it's moved into the daily fantasy space, just like it moved into the casino space. What's different about this is that they will say this is a daily fantasy deal. But if you are DraftKings, you're going to be building brand exposure around the NFL. You also operate a sports book. So just as similarly as you might say, Winstar Casino, for example, this is a great parallel. Winstar Casino does its deal with the Dallas Cowboys. Now, that deal was much, much more expensive this time around. And that's because Winstar expects down the line there will be legal sports betting in Oklahoma, and they will be able to draw NFL fans and particularly Cowboys fans, promote in front of them, and get them to their sports book, you know, their physical sports book or maybe even get them driving across the border to place a bet online if Oklahoma allows that. That changes the value of that deal. This one with DraftKings, similarly, you look at what a daily fantasy deal is in the NFL. Before sports betting, it's one thing. After sports betting, it's another, because whether it's DraftKings or DraftKings Sportsbook, it may be a different activity, but it's the same brand. And so you're raising your profile in front of NFL fans. You're raising your profile. Look, the DraftKings was, Jason Robbins was real straight about it. He's like, look, we like to run promotions where we say win tickets to the big game. No, we can say win tickets to the Super Bowl. This is the thing, though. If you're DraftKings, your most effective way of moving somebody to your sports book when it becomes legal is to convert them from daily fantasy. So everything you can build, do to build daily fantasy in a state accrues to building a consumer base in that state when you roll out sports
betting. Got it. And for the NFL, it means what? It's a sponsorship category.
It is. I think for the NFL, it's just one more indication that they're getting comfortable with this space.
But they're still not going all in terms of official casino.
Well, they have one. They have Caesars.
But as a sponsorship.
What the line they have not crossed,
right, that's
is
what I'm
sports books can't promote in the league. So a William Hill, a Bet 888, anybody like that can't promote their sports book in the league. And since those sports books don't have daily fantasy and those sports books don't have, you know, casinos with slot machines, they can't promote their brand in the NFL at all. So a William Hill, which has only a sports book, can't use this tangential brand to promote its sports book. DraftKings, you can call it DraftKings or DraftKings Sportsbook. You know, that's a pretty fine line between the difference of those. FanDuel or FanDuel Sportsbook, pretty fine line between the difference of those.
What's
MGM, pretty fine line between the difference
of those. And for the listeners and for me, the difference between MGM's deal with the NBA and the NFL's deal with Caesars.
The NFL can use, for example, the Super Bowl and do a Super Bowl promotion and put the Super Bowl logo and the NFL logos in its casinos all over the place. Caesars can use the Super Bowl to drive people to its casinos. Caesars can use the Super Bowl to give away tickets and to its best customers. It can do all those things.
They can use NFL IP in their marketing.
Exactly. In their marketing. What they can't do is use NFL marks on their sportsbook website. On their sportsbook app. They can't do those things. They can't promote sports betting through that relationship. They can promote the brand, which, by the way, could drive people to the sportsbook. That increases the value of that relationship to the casino. There's no doubt about it.
And I guess what I'm getting at is all the sentiment is that the NFL is just, you know, building this little creeping closer and closer, doing all these types of deals without going full bore in terms of promoting betting. And gambling.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Although, look, you can't watch an NFL game and not see the Fox Bet Pick 6, right? So the broadcaster on the game is certainly promoting its sports betting product.
So having it every way they want.
Every way they want.
Good stuff, Bill.
All right, thanks, Abe. That's going to do it for this week. For Abe Madcor, Eric Prisbel, Mark Burns, and our producer, Chris Mason, I'm Bill King, and this has been First Look.